let me see him just make sure he's lit up.
Okay.
Go on the record and come to order. The commission is hereby convened in open session Thursday, January 20th, 2011, to consider the matter entitled Secretary of Labor versus Ames Construction, docket number West 2009-693-M. Present are myself, Chairman Jordan, Commissioner Duffy, Commissioner Young, and Commissioner Cohen. Commissioner Nakamura is participating in this meeting by telephone. We will start with an overview of the case presented by Rory Smith of the Office of General Counsel. Good morning, Rory.
Good morning. In this civil penalty proceeding arising under the Federal Mine Safety and Health Act of 1977, the judge upheld the citation charging Ames Construction Incorporated with a significant and substantial violation of 30 CFR Section 569201. Section 569201 provides that equipment and supplies shall be loaded, transported, and unloaded in a manner which does not create a hazard to persons from falling or shifting equipment or supplies. The Commission subsequently granted Ames' petition for discretionary review, which challenges the judge's determination that Ames violated the safety standards. This proceeding concerns the events surrounding the delivery of pipe to the Kennecott Tailings Facility near Magna, Utah. Ames contracted with Kennecott to construct and raise a tailings dam, pipe and roadways at the Kennecott facility. As the construction of the facility progressed, it was necessary to extend a pipeline used to transport waste products. Therefore, Ames regularly received deliveries of pipe at the property. Approximately 60 to 70 loads of pipe were delivered there during 2008. The pipe was manufactured by WL Plastics and purchased by Kennecott. At the WL Plastics factory, the pipe would be loaded onto the trailer of a delivery truck bound to the tailing facility. The delivery truck in this proceeding was owned by Bob Orton Trucking and driven by an employee of Orton. The driver, William Kay, was 81 years old and had 55 years of experience as a truck driver. On October 29, 2008, Kay arrived at the tailing facility with a trailer loaded with 9 pipes, each of which was about 50 feet in length and 3,000 pounds of weight. After arriving at the facility, Kay stopped at the Ames office. It was the policy of the facility for Ames to escort outside drivers while they were on the property. Kay was escorted by 3 members of the Ames crew to the unloading area, Greg Davis, James Hiller, and Juan Flores. The Ames crew drove a separate truck during the approximately 8-mile-long drive. Upon reaching the designated unloading area, only Flores exited the Ames truck. Davis instructed Kay to remain at the unloading site. Davis and Hilton then left to retrieve a forklift located elsewhere on the facility, which was to be used to unload. Flores remained with Kay, but the two did not speak while they waited at the site. After the Ames truck left, Flores crossed the road and remained for several minutes before returning to the unloading area. Flores waited near the passenger side of the truck for the crew to return. Flores' attention was on the road when he heard a loud crack. The noise came from a pipe that had fallen from the trailer. The pipe fell after Kay had removed all the straps from the load in the absence of supplemental support. The removal of the straps caused one pipe to dislodge and roll off the trailer. The pipe struck Kay and led to fatal crushing injuries. At this time, Davis and Greg had not yet returned to the unloading area with a forklift. At the conclusion of the accident investigation, the Mine Safety and Health Administration issued a citation to Ames for an alleged violation of the safety standard and designated the violation as significant and substantial. Ames contested the citation as well as the associated civil penalty, which was proposed to be $13,268. After a hearing on the merits, the judge concluded that the secretary had established a violation and sustained her burden of proof that the citation was properly designated as significant and substantial. More specifically, the judge found that Ames was responsible for unloading the pipes in a safe manner and that the unloading process had begun once the truck was parked in the unloading area and the driver began to remove the straps. The judge found that Ames was strictly liable for the violation because Orton was a subcontractor of Ames. Additionally, the judge found that the truck driver was transporting pipes for the use of Ames on property that was under the control of Ames. In finding that Ames was strictly liable for the violent action, the judge relied, in part, on the commission's decision in Mingo Loading Coal Company, which states that the Act's scheme of liability provides that an operator, although faultless itself, may be held liable for violative acts of his employees, agents, and contractors. Both the secretary and Ames agree that the record contains no evidence of a contractual relationship between Ames and Orton. Ames concludes that given the absence of a contract relationship with Orton, it is not liable for the violation. Instead, it contends that it was a third-party bystander, and therefore the liability scheme applied by the judge was wholly misplaced. In its brief, Ames quarrels with the applicability of the case law relied on by the judge because the contract relationship between Ames and Orton was material to the judge's analysis and her ultimate finding of liability. Ames also disputes that it controlled the unloading area and specifically asserts that it was not in a supervisory position at the time the driver began to unstrap the load. The secretary asserts that Ames is strictly liable for the violation of the safety standard because it controlled and supervised the unloading area. She urges that the operator is strictly liable for violations that take place under his control or supervision, and relies heavily on the D.C. Circuit's decision in National Cement Company. The secretary also maintains that there were a number of measures that Ames could have undertaken to better protect miner safety during the unloading process. In his reply brief, Ames dismisses the relevance of National Cement because it involved two parties who were in a contractual relationship. Additionally, Ames contends that the secretary did not prove that Ames could have prevented the driver from unloading the truck in an unsafe manner. Finally, Ames asserts the secretary's position regarding strict liability does not deserve deference. Ames suggests the secretary has abandoned a policy of holding operators strictly liable for the violative acts of his contractors in favor of an impermissible ad hoc policy which holds operators strictly liable for violative acts which occur in areas under their control, regardless of contractor relationships. Ames asserts that it lacked fair notice of this policy and suggests the secretary's position does not warrant deference because her policy is not the product of ruling. At this time, I'd be glad to take any questions that you may have.
Anybody have any questions? Thank you very much, Warren.
Thank you.
We'll start off. Commissioner Young, I believe, is going to start off the discussion today.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Smith, I believe this is your first decisional memorandum, isn't it?
Yes.
Congratulations on a job well done. You have our thanks for that. Before I talk about the case, it struck me a little bit thinking about the men involved here, in particular Mr. K, 81 years old, and was still getting up every day to drive a truck. That doesn't make him any more unique. I know more unique is a non sequitur or more precious or special than any of the other miners whose safety is entrusted to the operators and the secretary under the act, but it does underscore how we're surrounded in our everyday lives by people who are, in their own way, unique and precious. And that brings me to Mr. Flores, who, from the record, clearly feels a burden of guilt and responsibility for what happened to Mr. Keck. When I was in private practice in North Carolina, we represented a man who had been riding in a car with his wife, and they were struck by another vehicle, and his wife was killed and he was seriously injured. And his life was devastated and ruined, obviously. But I felt for the defendant, too, who had taken her eyes off the road to change the radio station, by her testimony. And she was obviously haunted by what happened also. And that brings to mind, even the young people in this room maybe have experienced in your lives, a moment where you felt like you dodged one, where we have not been as attentive as we need to be when we're entrusted with an awesome responsibility like driving a car. And I hope we're mindful to those opportunities to do everything right, and not almost everything right, and to pay attention to the things we have to pay attention to when we're responsible in some way for the lives and safety of others. Getting back to this case, I see it boiling down to a very simple question, and I would not find it necessary to expand the scope or the reach of the Mine Act by deciding whether Ames should be liable for the actions of Horton Trucking, which was not a subcontractor to Ames. And I wouldn't find it necessary either to hold Ames liable simply because it controlled an area where the violation occurred, based on whether or not it had control of a physical area of the mine. The standard at issue in this case, 30 CFR section 569201, requires that equipment and supplies, including the pipes at issue here, shall be loaded, transported, and unloaded in a manner which does not create a hazard to persons from falling or shifting equipment or supplies. It's undisputed in this case that the area where Mr. K was killed was a mine, and that Mr. K was a miner, and that Ames was an operator, as those terms are defined in the Act. And it's also undisputed that Ames was responsible for unloading the pipes from the truck. And unfortunately, it's also beyond dispute that the pipes were unloaded in violation of that standard. In her decision, the judge held that the unloading process began when Ames left an employee with Mr. K at the unloading area. Under the Mine Act's strict liability scheme, Ames would be liable as an operator who violated the Act as long as that conclusion by the ALJ is supported by substantial evidence. And for me, that's the only relevant question. I would hold that it is supported by substantial evidence. That evidence includes the procedures developed by Ames for this very scenario, procedures designed to protect miners by waiting until the forklift was in place to accept the load before loosening the straps holding the pipes, procedures requiring communication and planning prior to the unloading, procedures requiring visiting miners like Mr. K to be escorted on the property so that they would not wander into danger. These procedures weren't followed perfectly in this instance, with fatal consequences. In assessing responsibility for those consequences, I would note that it was Ames who decided to leave Mr. Flores with Mr. K. This may be fairly viewed as the judge chose to view it as the beginning of the unloading process. Ames' own employee, Mr. Davis, observed that the pipes had been loaded without chocks, and I think this is further evidence that Ames recognized its responsibility for the unloading process had commenced. At that point, when Mr. Davis left Mr. Flores with Mr. K, Ames was in a position to control the process and therefore was responsible for it. We don't need to speculate about what might have happened had Ames said something to Mr. K to keep him from beginning the unloading before Ames's employees were ready. That might be important in a case where negligence were at issue. Were we apportioning fault, of course Mr. K was primarily at fault. He had years of experience, had been trained on the hazards at this site, and caused the hazard by his own action. One could reasonably assert, in negligence case, that Mr. K's actions were somewhat unexpected. But good operators, safety-conscious operators, develop procedures to anticipate human failing and error, as Ames did here. Good, safety-conscious operators have employees like Mr. Davis, who notice hazards like poorly loaded supplies. Good operators provide supervisions to ensure, as Mr. Sabat noted in his argument, that someone like Mr. K doesn't wander off into a dangerous situation. And in my mind, there's no difference between wandering off on the invisible side of the truck into a ravine and breaking your neck, and wandering off on the invisible side of the truck to begin the unloading process. Mr. Flores was left there for a reason. And that was a decision that Ames made. I do find it somewhat unjust to punish an operator who did so much right, who in fact did everything almost perfectly. Thoughtful planning, appropriate procedures, attention to possible hazards. But under a strict liability statute such as the Mine Act, almost perfect is not sufficient. If you're an operator at a mine and the process you're engaged in and responsible for is carried out in a way that violates the act or the regulations promulgated under it, you're liable. For me, that would be the end of the inquiry in this case. I appreciate very much the points skillfully impressed upon us by counsel at argument and in the briefs, and by Mr. Smith in the DM concerning control of the area and responsibility for the acts and omissions of other persons. But here we have a party who is directly and strictly responsible under the Act for a violation of the Act. The judge found all of the elements necessary to support a violation of the standard by Ames itself, and I would affirm the finding of violation on that basis and the penalty assessed by the judge. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Young. Next, we'll hear from Commissioner Duffy.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I commend you, Rory, on your debut decisional memorandum. It was most helpful to me in analyzing the issues presented in this case. I would note for you and my colleagues that I'm still analyzing those issues, and I've not reached a final position as to the best disposition of this case. Initially, I thought that despite some of the factual wrinkles in this case, the ultimate decision would turn on general principles of strict liability under the Mine Act. That is, that Ames, as an independent contractor slash operator under the Act, could be held liable for this violation. However, as both the Secretary and Ames correctly argued, that liability could not arise, as the judge found, from the fact that Orton Trucking was a subcontractor of Ames. Rather, I had initially viewed Ames' liability as arising from its control of the unloading function at the tailings facility owned by Kennecott Mining. However, several thought-provoking points made by counsel for Ames at last week's oral argument have caused me to rethink my initial position. In short, I am considering whether the Secretary presented adequate evidence below regarding Ames' responsibilities at the tailings facility to establish liability under the criteria set forth by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in the National Cement case. That case stands, among other things, for the proposition that strict liability may not necessarily arise in certain circumstances involving entities that do not have a contractual relationship. Thus, it becomes incumbent upon the Secretary to establish Ames' liability for the actions of an employee of a third party, here, Orton Trucking, in the absence of any contractual relationship between Ames and Orton. These circumstances constitute new ground, in my view, that requires further thought. So I'm not in a position to uphold the judge's ultimate conclusion of liability at this time. All I do know is that her rationale based on a mischaracterization of the contractual relationship between Ames and Orton does not support a finding of liability. A threshold issue that I am also considering is what constitutes the act of unloading the pipe in this case. Does it begin when the Ames employees bring the forklift to the delivery truck and hold the meeting to plan the unloading process, or does it begin whenever the delivery driver, who is not an employee of Ames, takes unilateral actions, authorized or not, and foreseeable or not, prior to Ames' assembly of the equipment and the personnel to start the intended unloading process. I will be considering these questions to reach a final position on this case, but for now, Madam Chairman, I will forego voting on the disposition at this time.
Thank you, Commissioner Duffy. Commissioner Cullen?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I, too, thank Rory Smith for the decisional memorandum in this case. Rory's first one for the Commission and one that I substantially agree with. I would also thank Rory for his work assembling the record and clarifying the exhibits, which was a little bit difficult in this case. The problem in the case is that the judge concluded that Mr. K's employer, Bob Orton Trucking, was a contractor for Ames Construction. As the Secretary acknowledges, Orton is not Ames' contractor. The question then is whether the Commission can and should affirm the judge's decision in result. I conclude that the Commission should do so largely for the reasons stated by Commissioner Young. I will start with the legal issue of whether Ames, as the independent contractor of Kennecott, Utah Copper, hired and responsible for construction projects at the Kennecott Tailings Facility, can be held liable under the Mine Act for the violation of 30 CFR Section 56.9201 when the physical unloading of the section of pipe which created the hazard was done by an employee of a separate and unrelated company. Ames contends that the Secretary is asking the Commission to, quote, manufacture new law. While I agree with Ames that there is no Commission legal precedent which is precisely on point, in the sense that the decided cases involve the liability of an operator for acts of its contractor, this does not mean that the Secretary is seeking to manufacture new law. Rather, the law exists and merely is being applied to a different fact pattern. Section 110A1 of the Mine Act provides that, quote, the operator of a coal or other mine in which a violation occurs of a mandatory health or safety standard shall be assessed a civil penalty. It is undisputed that the accident which killed Mr. K resulted from a violation of 30 CFR Section 56.9201 in that the unloading of the pipe created a hazard. The question then is whether Ames was the operator of a mine where the violation occurred. Clearly, the location of the violation was a mine, as that word is defined in Section 30H1 of the Mine Act. The issue is whether Ames was an operator. In this regard, Section 3D of the Mine Act defines operator as, quote, any owner, lessee, or other person who operates, controls, or supervises a mine, or, quote, any independent contractor performing services or construction at such mine. The Secretary's theory is that Ames is liable for the violation because it controlled the area where the violation occurred and supervised the process of unloading the pipe. I believe that the Secretary's theory is not an extension of the law, but rather is within the scope of the D.C. Circuit's decision in National Cement. That case involved the liability of National Cement for installing berms or guardrails along the road leading to its plant. The court noted that, quote, an entity cannot be held liable unless it operates, controls, or supervises the mine. In response to the argument that mine operators are subject to strict liability for violation of MSHA standards, the court said that strict liability, quote, does not mean liability for things that occur outside one's control or supervision. The Secretary's theory in this case is really nothing more than a reformulation of this principle. The Secretary's theory is also consistent with the majority opinion of Commissioner Duffy and me in the recent Musser Engineering decision, 32 Femschrick 1257. In that case, we concluded that the role of an independent contractor engineering company which had prepared a base map used by the mine operator in preparing the map required under 30 CFR section 75-1200 was insufficient to bring it within the standard. The opinion in Musser Engineering quoted the court in National Cement in concluding that Musser did not exercise sufficient control to render it liable. Hence, I conclude that the Secretary's theory is not an extension of the law, although its application is to a different set of facts. This is not a situation where the Secretary is seeking to hold a contractor liable for something over which it had no control, nor is it a situation such as the one hypothetically described by Ames's counsel at oral argument, where Ames could allegedly be held liable for actions by another contractor 5 miles away at another part of the mine. Indeed, at oral argument, counsel for Ames conceded that there could be circumstances in which it would be liable for a violation of the unloading standard by a non-related party such as Orton, based on its control and supervision of the unloading process. And as with, I think, Commissioner Young, I'm speaking of an unloading process more than an unloading area. The judge's decision addressed the issues of control and supervision. On page 4, the judge found that the property where the accident occurred was under the control of Ames. On page 5, the judge spoke of Ames's responsibility for making sure the unloading process was being done correctly and safely. And I think it's useful here to consider the actual language that the judge used, which was as follows. I agree with the MSHA inspector and find that once the mine escorted Kay to the unloading site and left an employee with him, while they retrieved the forklift, the unloading process had begun, and Ames was responsible for doing it correctly, i.e., not allowing the restraints to be removed from the load until the forklift was in place and the load secured so that it could be safely unloaded. The unloading process includes parking the truck in the correct location so that the mine employees along with the driver can begin the physical removal of the pipe from the truck. Once the truck is in position and a member of the pipe crew is present for the sole purpose of unloading, it can be said that unloading has begun. Clearly, the judge was speaking here and making findings about Ames's supervision of the unloading process. Specifically, the judge found that Ames's supervision and control of the unloading process, and hence its responsibility under the Mine Act, had commenced as of the time that Mr. K parked his truck in the unloading area. So the issue becomes whether these findings are supported by substantial evidence. In real terms, as the Secretary argues, substantial evidence supports the conclusion that Ames was exercising supervision and control as of the time that Mr. K parked his truck in the unloading area. It was at this point that Ames employee Greg Davis instructed Mr. K to, quote, stay right there. This instruction is a clear expression of supervisory authority. Davis and James Hilton left Juan Flores to supervise Mr. K, and Mr. Flores acknowledged that he was responsible for Mr. K's safety. Moreover, Ames Superintendent Scott Lunsford testified that the members of the Ames pipe crew were lead men who had authority to make sure that work was being performed safely and to stop unsafe work. Equally important is the stipulation of the parties on the record at the end of the hearing. It was stipulated that Orton drivers are instructed to follow the policies, procedures, and instructions of the recipient regarding safety and the unloading process. It was also stipulated that Orton drivers are not to remove or loosen their straps until instructed to do so by the supervisor of the unloading process. Although this stipulation is phrased in terms of the instructions which Orton gives its drivers, its language establishes that the recipient, Ames Construction, is in charge of the unloading process and supervises an Orton driver such as Mr. K. Ames contends that the unloading process had not begun as of the time when Mr. K was killed. According to Ames, the unloading process does not begin until after the safety meeting, which was supposed to occur when Davis and Hilton returned to Kay's truck with a forklift. The judge found to the contrary, and her decision in that regard is supported by substantial evidence and consistent with the protective purposes of the Mine Act. If Ames did not have supervisory responsibility as of the time that Kay parked the truck, there would have been no reason for Davis to tell him to stay right there, or for Flores to be left with Kay. One could ask hypothetically, if Flores had also been injured by the falling pipe which killed Kay, would Ames still be claiming that it had no responsibility for the violation under the Mine Act? Ames contends that there was no evidence of record going to the issue of its control and supervision of the unloading process. By this argument, Ames seems to imply that without evidence of the actual legal contract between it and Kennecott, setting forth the particulars of Ames's control and supervision, its rights to discipline a person such as Mr. Kay, etc., the Secretary's case must fail. I disagree. There is considerable evidence of Ames's actual control of the unloading area and process, both in the testimony of Ames witnesses, including Ames Industrial Division Manager Robert Parker, and in the stipulation offered at the end of the trial. Moreover, through the testimony of Superintendent Lunsford, Ames offered in evidence as Government Exhibit 8 a document entitled Safety, Health, and Environmental Action Plan. Lunsford described this document as, quote, our project scope of work. Although the precise origin of the document is not stated in the record, it clearly and repeatedly refers to Kennecott's safety standards and policies, which Ames must adhere to. As Lunsford stated, there is a section of the document which specifically addresses the unloading of materials with forklifts. Thus, this document represents evidence of Kennecott's formal delegation to Ames of responsibility for the safe unloading of materials from delivery trucks and Ames's acceptance of that responsibility. Finally, Ames contends that it cannot be held liable in this case because it was not on notice that control and supervision of the unloading process would be the basis for the Secretary seeking to hold it liable. At oral argument, counsel for Ames claimed that this issue is being raised for the first time on appeal and asserted that the Commission had no jurisdiction to even consider it. I disagree. I think that Ames did have sufficient notice that its control and supervision of the unloading process was the basis for its liability. Although the judge made an incorrect determination that Orton was a subcontractor of Ames as part of her decision, this was in the context of a decision which found that Ames controlled the area and also found that the unloading process, which Ames controlled, had begun at the time when Mr. Kay unstrapped the load on his truck. Ames cannot claim surprise. The Secretary had set forth this theory both in her pre-hearing statement and in her opening statement at trial. The pre-hearing statement states, quote, the Secretary contends that Ames became legally responsible for the safe unload of William Kay's pipe on October 29, 2008, once Ames began to escort William Kay's truck at the tailings facility. At least impliedly, this is a statement that liability attaches upon the commencement of control and supervision. The Secretary was very clear in her counsel's opening statement at trial. In this opening statement, the Secretary said that the dispositive issue is the point in time when Ames assumed responsibility for the pipes on Mr. Kay's truck. In this regard, Secretary's counsel outlined five specific factual contentions, three of which directly stated that Ames exercised supervision and control at the time that Mr. Kay unstrapped the pipe. If Ames was going to claim surprise or object to the scope of the Secretary's evidence, it would have been at the conclusion of the Secretary's opening statement, but Ames did not do so. Thus, Ames was fully on notice of the Secretary's contentions regarding control and supervision at the time of the hearing. As the Secretary noted in footnote 2 of her brief, citing the Supreme Court decision in Dandridge v. Williams, It is well established that a party which prevailed below may urge an argument on appeal which supports the decision below, even if the lower court did not reach that argument. In Dandridge, the court said that, quote, when attention has been focused on other matters, or when the court from which a case comes has expressed no views on a controlling question, it may be appropriate to remand the case rather than deal with the merits of that question, unquote. Here at trial, the parties litigated the issue of control and supervision in the context of the question of when the unloading process began, and it was addressed in the judge's factual findings. Hence, I do not believe that it is necessary to remand this case back to the judge pursuant to Dandridge. I conclude that the judge's conclusion that Ames violated 30 CFR section 56.9201 should be affirmed in result. Since Ames did not challenge the amount of the penalty, it too should be affirmed.
Thank you, Commissioner Cohen. Next, we'll hear from Commissioner Nakamura.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. First, I'd like to thank the Chairman and my colleagues, the General Counsel and the parties, for allowing me to participate by telephone. And I can tell you that I'm not wearing a necktie this morning.
Rub it in.
Secondly, I would like to thank Rory for a fine decisional memorandum. I know it is the first one, and he did a very fine job.
We're unanimous on that, at least.
I am thinking at this time that, well, first, I think clearly everyone agrees that the decision can't be affirmed on the basis of the judge's reasoning that there was a contractual relationship between Ames and Morton. Both parties concede that there's no evidence to support that contractual relationship. The Secretary, of course, has advanced an alternative basis for finding liability, and that is that the AIM construction is an operator that, which is defined under 3D of the Act as any owner, lessee, or other person who operates, controls, or supervises a coal or other mine. I think the what the Secretary has argued here is that the AIM construction is a person, in this case a subcontractor for Kennecott, who operates, controls, or supervises the mine, in this case the tailings facility. I am willing to agree with the Secretary that based on language of National Cement, the holding of National Cement, that a contractor in a position like Ames would be liable as an operator for the acts of a third party on the mine site that it controls. And I don't find that to be a great leap in this case, or in general, because if a subcontractor like Ames Construction is basically stands in the shoes of Kennecott for certain purposes at the mine, then I find that strict liability is based on our previous cases would be warranted, and also promotes the policies of the Act, I think as described by Commissioner Young. I do have a concern in this case, and that is, I think as Commissioner Cohen stated under Dandridge v. Williams, well, let me back up. You know, the operator did have good grounds for filing the petition for discretionary review because the judge did err in finding that there was this contractual relationship. In the secretary's brief, they advanced an alternative basis for liability. And as Commissioner Cohen stated, under Dandridge v. Williamson, the secretary can do that, so we can certainly entertain an alternative basis. As Commissioner Cohen also stated in footnote 6 of that decision, if the alternative basis was not fully litigated by the parties, then remand might be appropriate. And it's my belief that this case should be remanded for the purpose of allowing the parties to at least argue to the judge the merits of whether or not Ames Construction did have control over the mine property and, in particular, the unloading site. Let me say this, that when you look at the transcript and the record, it seems to me that the question of control was assumed by the parties, but I don't see that was actually made a stipulation in the record. The parties litigated this case, at least the operator litigated the case below, by trying to really show that the unloading had not yet begun, and therefore it could not be cited for a violation of the regulation. And I don't think the issue of control was front and center as an issue litigated by the parties below. I would admit that in looking at the record, it may be that it wasn't litigated because the record evidence is pretty overwhelming that they were in control of this area of the mine. In particular, I think the safety, health, and environmental action plan, which was the Secretary's Exhibit 8, is the one document that shows the kind of authority that Ames had on behalf of Kennecott at the tailings facility. However, I think that for purposes of fairness to the operator, I would allow remand the case back to the judge for purposes of making specific findings on the issue of control. And I guess lastly, I would affirm the judge's findings that that the unloading process began at the time the truck was actually parked. I think there's substantial evidence to support that finding. But other than that, I would adopt the secretary's argument. To sum up, I would adopt the secretary's argument that if Ames had control, that it would be strictly liable for violations committed by the third party in this case, or the truck even, Mr. K. But I would affirm the finding that the unloading process had begun at the time the truck was parked. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Nakamura. I find myself in agreement with my colleagues, Commissioner Young and Commissioner Cohen, in that I would affirm the judge's finding of violation in this case. I also would like to first thank Rory for your helpful DM and also your help in responding to inquiries and checking records and nailing down additional facts. I appreciate that. I start, as Commissioner Cohen pointed out, I mean, the statutory basis that we have here is that Section 110 allows the Secretary, in fact, requires the Secretary to assess a penalty against an operator of a mine in which a violation has occurred. There's no dispute that Ames is an operator of this facility, this tailing facility. I don't believe it disputes that, and there's certainly no dispute that there was a violation of 56.9201 that occurred at this mine. So really, starting off with 110 of the statute, it seems to me that the Secretary is able to cite an operator at a mine in which a violation occurred, and that for there to be no authority of the Secretary to cite the operator, there really has to be a situation presented or demonstrated where the operator being cited really has no control or ability over the situation. That is not the case here. The record amply demonstrates that it is logical, reasonable, consistent with the policies and purposes of the Act, that Ames should be cited for the violation that occurred. Ames, although there was no contractual relationship, I believe that in this record, the only reasonable conclusion to be drawn is that Ames had sufficient control over the situation. First of all, the drivers, Wharton drivers, are instructed by their own employer, and this was stipulated into the record, that they are to follow the instructions of the supervisor of the unloading process. So the drivers leaving Wharton, they don't consider themselves free agents when they arrive, that they're under the control of no one. They're specifically instructed, you're under the instruction of the recipient. When they arrive at the mine, they go straight to Ames' office. They don't proceed to just drive through the property. They're asked to show their training certificate. If they receive the hazard training certificate, they produce that. They're escorted from when they enter the mine to the spot where Ames needs them to go. I dare say if the driver along the way decided to disregard, you know, and to go off in a different area or to exceed a speed limit, which I believe is in place on the property and enforced by Ames, that Ames would not view itself as a third-party bystander with no ability to stop a driver who was acting dangerously even before it got to the site. As pointed out by Commissioner Cohen, there's Ames employees involved too, and a vendor, a delivery person who comes onto the property that's under Ames' control, who proceeds to endanger Ames employees, certainly we would consider it a rather anomalous and incongruous situation not intended by Congress or under 110, but the operator told that property to say, we have no contractual relationship with this delivery person, this vendor, and if they careen through the property and endanger even one of our employees, we cannot be held liable. They're escorted from the point of entry to the point where they are supposed to unload the pipes. I didn't find myself really focusing so much on, you know, exactly when Ames liability springs in place. I mean, I view them as in control of this area, and the driver entering the property, that Ames would be liable for a violation of 56.9201. Mind you, the standard at which we're dealing with here isn't just regarding unloading. It does say that equipment and supplies shall be loaded, transported, and unloaded in a manner which does not create a hazard to persons from falling or shifting equipment or supplies. So I don't think Ames would, you know, not be responsible. I mean, if I don't think this can, you know, hinge on were they not loading or unloading yet until the forklift came back. Ames is in control. It's the operator at the tailings facility. The driver arrives. They escort them. They check their training. to me, you know, the demarcation of has unloading officially started yet, so therefore, you know, does Ames liability come into place? I have not admittedly saw a need to think about that distinction too much, but when I looked at the reg, I do see that it really covers the whole process, loading, transport, and unloading. So for Ames, I just think, I don't think it's an expansion of the law. I agree with my colleagues in that regard. Section 110 has always been construed that an operator in which a mine, of a mine in which violation occurs can be held liable. The operator doesn't have to take the action that results in the violation. There can be more than one operator of a mine. They can be jointly and severally liable. The secretary has discretion as to various operators and which operator they can proceed to go against. So here, Ames concedes it's an operator. It, at this facility, concedes that a violation of the standard occurred at this facility. And really, starting from there, you'd have to come, you know, I mean, I could see where if you had a situation where I think Commissioner Duffy raised hypothetically at an oral argument, you know, what if you had an operator down here 5 miles down the road? Are you going to cite the other operator over here? I agree. Those cases would be problematic, admittedly. I mean, if you had somebody constructing a preparation plant over on one side of the mine and somehow MSHA's coming after them for something that happened with the people who were sinking the shaft at the other end of the mine, which the operator at the preparation plant has no involvement with, would have no idea how it should be done, couldn't fix the problem if it wanted to. Okay, in that situation, yes, to draw some boundaries. But we do not have that here. This is far from that situation, in my mind. And so the fact that the judge erroneously determined that there was a contractual relationship between Ames and Borton Trucking, in my view, amounts to harmless error. Had there been a contractual relationship, that's one more indicia of a way that Ames could have exercised control. It could have severed a contract, or it's viewed as a means, another avenue, another aspect of control. But without that fact, there's still ample indicia of control in my mind in this record. And I don't agree that we would need to remand this case for the parties to argue the issue of control before the judge. They did have the opportunity to argue those positions to us. And so I'm not sure why it would need to be remanded. And in fact, in this record, in my mind, I don't see how it would support a finding of no control. I mean, I don't really see how the judge, you know, remanded to the judge that she could conclude on this record that there was no control, such insufficient control by Ames that in fact it could not, under the law, be held liable for this violation. So I find myself, you know, not agreeing to that route here. And I guess I would just also point out that it's appropriate for Ames to be cited for this violation, as counsel for Ames pointed out in the oral argument. There's one circuit, at least, that would consider Orton Trucking not an operator, simply a vendor. And so that would mean that we have a mine in which a violation occurred. Who is the operator to be cited? Well, here it would be, you know, Ames, Kennecott. Now, I don't think people would think Kennecott is a particularly more appropriate entity to be cited. So that would be Ames. So it's the operator of the mine in which a violation occurred. So not only is it reasonable for the secretary to cite Ames, Ames may actually be the most reasonable entity if the secretary were considering the ruling in the Seventh Circuit that Orton Trucking may not even be considered an operator. The Ames employee was very near that truck, as Commissioner Cohen pointed out. In my mind, you know, for Ames to say we were not in charge or the process hadn't started enough that we were in control, their employee, Mr. Flores, was standing right next to the truck when the straps were loosened and the pipes fell off. I mean, could we not consider that perhaps he might have been endangered by the falling pipes? As Commissioner Cohen pointed out, do we have a situation then when Ames is saying, well, we're just a third-party bystander vis-a-vis Mr. K and his actions, and even though, you know, our employee could potentially be endangered by that person's actions on property that's under our control during a process that we are in charge of, but the part of the process that we're really in charge of hadn't actually quite occurred yet, so we're just a third-party bystander vis-a-vis Mr. K until we actually get the forklift over there. I just find that to be an unreasonable construction. So I would affirm the judge, as I did, and result. Any other questions or comments?
Just for Mr. Smith's benefit, in drafting, I just want to make clear that while I may have ultimately a disagreement or two on a finer legal point with him, Mr. or Commissioner Cohen expressed in greater detail my view of the case. So if you're looking for an opinion with at least the two of us on it, that'd be a good place to start. It's the way he articulated things.
Well, that's true. I should ask Mr. Smith whether you have questions for us that you need clarification or want to explore in terms of drafting the opinion. Of course, that doesn't preclude you from discussing things with us after today, too, to figure out how to the best way to draft the opinion and issues.
At this time, I don't have any questions.
Okay. Yeah. All right, well, I think I join in my colleagues in thanking you very much for your help today, Mr. Smith. And if we have no more comments or questions, we'll be adjourned.
Yes.
All right. Well, I hope it got recorded between the two of them. We don't want to have to go through.